101.5 FM, listener sponsored community radio.
Hello, New York. My name is Jerry Otero, a.k.a. Mr. O. I hope you'll join me for the new New York edition of The Morning Show, Fridays from 6 to 8 a.m. A New Yorker born and bred, this city has shown me the good side of bad, the downside of up, and everything in between. From street urchin to heroin addict to psychologist to father to mentoring the city's youth to drug policy and social reform activist, I've lived many lives here. I just love this city. I mean, where else could a Jewish boy like my dad meet a Puerto Rican hottie like my mom? There's something you should know about me, though, is I'm a troublemaker. And together we'll be examining this city's contradictions and the dirty political underbelly of how things really go down when security is a growth industry, all the while celebrating our beauty and cultural diversity. So join me for The Morning Show with Mr. O, the new New York edition, starting Friday, September 29th from 6 to 8 a.m. right here on WBAI New York. I promise I'll do my very best to make Grandpa Al Lewis proud.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
White nationalism. Attacks on abortion clinics, anti-immigration policy. It's all happening at once, but what are the connections? Far-right Republican Stephen King has tweeted, "You can't rebuild your civilization with other people's babies." And people like him want to control who has those babies. On Sunday, September 24th, 6 to 7 p.m., join the Joy of Resistance as we connect the dots with journalist Lauren Rankin, Sister Song founder Loretta Ross, attorney Farah Diaz-Tello, and Elizabeth Estrada of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. That's this Sunday, 6 to 7 p.m., Joy of Resistance, multicultural feminist radio at WBAI, putting it all together.
Religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
You are tuned to WBAI.
I want my freedom.
New York. 99.5 FM.
You gotta get me my freedom!
Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
Hi, my name is Jossie. I'm a volunteer at WBAI. Volunteers, producers, and management at WBAI have come to the conclusion that fund drives have become too damn long. Don't get it twisted. We love connecting with our listeners and are honored by every single dollar your generosity has inspired you to give the station. But we prefer our unique WBAI programming to long fundraising periods. WBAI is committing right now to making a change. WBAI management is committed to shortening the length of our marathons. That's why from now until October 2nd, we're conducting a quiet campaign to raise funds prior to the start of the actual marathon. Visit WBAI.org to make a pledge and follow our progress via the thermometer on the website. There are new donation buttons which allow for smaller donations for listeners. If we can raise $50,000, we'll shorten our fall fundraiser by 2 days. Every little bit helps, so consider making a pledge today at WBAI.org. And thank you, as always, for your support.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, our guest, as we try to do at least every September, is Richard Bowes. Also a movie review coming up from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, so we're 3/4 of the way through 2017, and there's no argument it's been kind of a crappy year. But you gotta look at the bright side, okay? Like, at least there's been no real progress on the attempt to make a live-action version of the Japanese anime classic Akira. I can understand the reasoning behind trying to transition animated films to the realm of flesh and blood. Mostly it's to bring in that large portion of the audience that would never be caught dead going to a quote-unquote cartoon, no matter how much that cartoon might be stuff that they would otherwise like. But for all number of reasons, not excluding the fact that one of the things that gives anime its power is that it is anime, not live action. So far, there are no attempts at porting anime to live action that have actually worked. It's no surprise that the live-action version of Ghost in the Shell has basset hounds in it. Director Rupert Sanders is apparently obsessed with reassuring fans of the original anime feature that he knows, or thinks he knows, what they're looking for, all the way down to replicating anime director Mamoru Oshii's fascination with squat, depressed-looking dogs. Whole sequences here are direct lifts from the animated film, although frequently with a contextual shift that robs the scene of what power it had in the original film. Occasionally, Sanders, who previously directed the less-than-impressive Snow White and the Huntsman, goes overboard with this, especially in the establishing shots of Newport City, the futuristic Hong Kong/Tokyo hybrid that is the setting for this far future cyber thriller, and that here is so clogged with stories tall advertising holograms that it looks like giant geishas have invaded midtown Manhattan. I will say this, those kinds of hyperbolic visuals do make Ghost in the Shell a hell of a film to look at, but that doesn't particularly mean that Sanders has grasped the themes of the original anime, which is what set it apart from the pack. Set in a future where cyborg enhancements are commonplace, Sanders follows Oshii's and manga artist Masamune Shirow's lead in throwing out disorienting visions of humanity's technological evolution. Human hands split off into dozens of mechanical tendrils, the top halves of faces flip up to reveal access ports, robotic geishas become spider-like assassins with blooming death flower faces. It's creepy and beautiful. Unfortunately, Sanders has seen fit to alter the underlying theme of the original film, which dealt with the protagonist Major Motoko Kusanagi's growing concern about the validity of her own humanity as she encounters victims of a notorious ghost hacker, a guy who reprograms cybernetic brains, called the Puppet Master, into a more conventional corporate conspiracy thriller as the Major, played by Scarlett Johansson and no longer called Kusanagi for reasons that are revealed later in the film, fights a hacker named Kuze, played by Michael Pitt, who's out to expose the dark secret behind the creation of the Major's cybernetic body. Okay, so it could be argued that I'm splitting hairs here, that I'm getting head up because we're getting RoboCop as opposed to Blade Runner. But there was a subtle power to how the original Ghost's central question intermeshed with its setting. What happens when doubt is cast into the fundamental fact of the world you live in? That's lost when it's turned into just another evil industrialist hiding their crimes kind of thing. It doesn't help that the ending of the film is especially atrocious, once again quoting from the original film, but trashing the themes behind it. It's the kind of ending that traditionally is said to have been focus grouped to death. But I suspect that hedging has now become so ingrained in the mindthink of corporate filmmakers that no focus groups were actually needed. They just backed away without particularly bothering themselves with how much they betrayed the whole point of the original film. No amount of superficial replication could make up for that. And let me point out that even if you don't know from the original anime, that ending is probably going to smell for you as well. So, actually, we've got something better than we usually get with these things, but it still falls short. Ghost in the Shell is an impressive-looking SF action film. It's certainly entertaining. It does make attempts to honor the themes and intent of the Oshi original, even though it drops the ball in that regard. Didn't regret watching it, but was disappointed that the things that made the anime special got lost in the translation. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan Persons, and everybody who went into doing that. I'm going to have to listen to that because we were just chatting about movies. And Weeby, me, Jim Freund, guest, Rick Bowes, otherwise, but if you look at one of his books, it's Richard Bowes.
It's Richard Bowes there. It's the only time I use Richard, but there it is.
Okay, yeah, we're looking for a volume on you. I am not engineering. I'm very unused to not engineering. We are working with Madeline Flieger, who's also becoming an engineer when available for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
That's me. Hello.
Hello. Hello. I'm so pleased that you could be here at this absurd hour.
Thank you. I am often on this block at absurd hours. I have an internship down the street from here.
Really?
Yes.
That's it, because you used to have an internship somewhere in this building.
Yes, no, not in this building anymore.
Yes.
But I work at a performing arts venue on 3rd Avenue and Atlantic Avenue now.
Wow. Okay, what place
is it? It's called Roulette. If anyone's interested, I would check it out. Lots of experimental theater, dance, audio. It's pretty cool stuff.
Ooh, I will have to check that out myself. Yeah, so, but you are not interning now. We gave you a title.
Yes.
At the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and wasn't associate producer, because that can mean anything.
I think it was associate engineer, wasn't it? Or assistant engineer.
It was assistant engineer because I was supposed to engineer. Only problem was you did the whole thing.
Ah, yes.
So you weren't the assistant, you were the engineer.
The student becomes the master.
But yeah, but as we are evolving the whole thing and hoping that you stay with us, we have, you know, we'll have like a permanent title, like Terrence Taylor is our technical director, whether he is there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the curator.
The host extraordinaire.
I'm not always the host, you see.
Ah.
Was I the host last month? No. Yes. Yes, I was. I was both host and engineer, which is a lot of fun, running back and forth for Cassandra Caw and Randy Dawn, who were the readers, and they were darned good.
Yes, yeah, that was a nice reading.
Yeah, and
I had been told to come to see the young lady
by Ellen. Ellen Datlow.
A couple of other people.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Ellen Datlow was the person who connected me with Cassandra, yes. Probably because there wasn't room for her at KGB.
Well, she was there tonight, and...
Cassandra?
Yeah, she wasn't reading, but she was there.
Yeah, I would hope so. No, she's only in town for like another week or so.
I guess, yeah, she was talking with a tour editor, she's going someplace.
Well, given that, is his volume too low?
I'd move a little closer to the mic if I were you.
Yeah, just wheel your chair.
Oh, this is what happens.
Oh, much better.
Much better.
It's what happens when you spend 35 years in a library.
Yes.
I've got library voice about as badly as it's possible to have it.
Maybe that's the song we should cue up is... Marion, Madam Librarian.
Marion Librarian.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't feel as one with the librarian and
I even
music,
liked
man.
The TV show version with Matthew Broderick.
I can't say I ever saw that one.
It's not bad. Decent choreography, more dancing than in the movie.
Yes,
and Matthew was actually, I can call him that because we worked together over 30 years ago, Torch Song Trilogy.
Oh, wow.
Well, it was, to begin with, it was a musical for the theater, so that it's coming back to that, sort of it's going to the place it should have been.
Yeah.
The movie, well, it's...
The movie has Robert Preston. That's enough for me.
You can't beat Robert Preston. I mean, he originated the role on Broadway.
Yeah, he really did. It would have been nice to see Barbara Cook.
I saw him.
You know, I
on
think
Broadway,
I did see Barbara Cook on Broadway as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen her in cabarets.
No, I saw her in a Sondheim. I saw her in a Sondheim musical. And I'm not going to remember the name of it because I don't remember.
I know that she did a couple of Sondheim reviews.
Right, but she, well, I can't.
She would
can't
not be that. A good Mrs. Lovett, I will tell you that.
No, she would have to become much more brutal.
I think so, which Barbara Cook generally is not. It was Shirley Jones, actually, in the movie.
Shirley Jones, that was who I saw on Broadway. That's right, she was in a revival of 42nd Street. It was a long time ago. I must have been...
A long time ago.
It must have been like 2004, 2005.
Yeah. I actually... Rick and I have had a standing argument about which was better, 42nd Street with Jerry Orbach or the revival, which is probably what you saw.
I think that is what I saw.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry
which
Orbach...
was choreographed by Walter Bobby.
Sounds right.
Jerry Orbach had, like... God love Jerry Orbach.
Absolutely.
I mean, he
was so right for that part.
Well, where he came from, it was Three Penny Opera. He happened to be playing the street musician when suddenly everybody discovered that that song that Louis Armstrong was singing was actually from an off-Broadway show. And the person who...
Fantastic.
Was, that was Jerry Orbach. And the next thing he did was, The Fantastics.
Yes.
He then did The Fantastics. And that, I
for years.
Believed, I, well, yes, I believed that that meant he was appointed by God. But yeah, he...
And then he did Law and Order for so long that people didn't know this guy
you know,
knew
I lived,
music.
I lived in the neighborhood where they did a lot of the Law and Order taping filming. And
they do a lot of it in Bay Ridge.
No. This was a little different. They did it around the police academy because the police academy had the police garage under it, and they could use all of the police equipment. But they also constantly, and they do it in the neighborhood I live in now also, they said, if you have a view of 17th Street from your window, please tell us. We will give you $1,000 and shoot some scenes from your window. And a woman went around. These things were everywhere. And she wrote, "Don't do it. The smell of Jerry Orbach's cigar will never leave your apartment."
Oh, God. I have a friend, a doctor, actually my therapist, Mr. Robot, often filmed in her apartment.
Oh, really?
And she hadn't even heard of the show. And this was during the first, the good season. And
I have to say, I have not seen it yet.
It is, the first season was really good. And the end of the first season was a great spoiler type season. The second season was, let's repeat that spoiler over and over and over. What I'm really looking forward to was on earlier tonight, speaking of spoilered shows, The Good Place.
With Kristen Bell?
Yes.
I think I watched the first episode of that. It was pretty funny.
And, yeah.
What is it?
I think it's about a woman who winds up in heaven, a.k.a. The Good Place, but she's been mixed up with a human rights lawyer, and it turns out she's actually a terrible person, and they just mixed up the names, and she obviously doesn't want to tell anyone because she doesn't want to go to the bad place.
Yeah, and the head of The Good Place is, the architect is Ted Danson. And the thing is, now this show is done by Drew Goddard. Mm-hmm. So when you think, let's do a sitcom, the first place you go to is the writer-director of Cabin in the Woods, right? What was that one, the one that he did for J.J. Abrams with the monster first camera?
Oh, Super 8?
No. No, that was
Abrams. Cloverfield.
Cloverfield. That was it. He did that as well. And he is the writer, director, or writer, showrunner of The Good Place. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, The Good Place is one of the few... I fell off the sitcom wagon years ago. There are very few that I've liked. I totally recommend The First Place. The problem is, and what happens is, it starts being like funny. It's a decent sitcom. And then there are a few things that build up and build up. And you're starting to notice a few things. And by the time you get to the last episode of the first season, I might as well say the spoiler, because the second season started last night, Wednesday night.
Yeah, I think the statute of limitations is over, I think.
Because by now, everybody knows. And what happens is, Kristen Bell and the other characters who were swapped, and all the bad people who are in there to be good people, have figured out they're not in the good place. Oh. It's actually all along, it's been the bad place. They were in a Sartre-esque hell with Ted Danson as the devil.
That is awesome.
That is one of the most brilliant twists in sitcom history.
That is a great twist.
So at the end of the first season, is it Kristen or Kirsten?
Kristen
Bell,
I think.
Kristen Bell. I'm hearing an echo. Kristen Bell, Ted Danson is going to redesign and start over again. He's going to wipe everybody's minds and start his great experiment over again. Only she has written a note for herself and put it under her tongue. And then her mind and everybody else's mind, except Ted Danson's, is wiped. And now, welcome to season 2, where it's The Good Place 2.0, where they're going to redo everything that they did in season 1. Only the question is, how long before they discover that they're in hell? Mm. And then what are they going to do about it? And Ted Danson has superiors that are not happy that he screwed up. So that, I mean, that's not your normal...
It's not your average sitcom.
Yeah, exactly. So... So now that I've spoiled season 1 for everybody...
I was going to say...
Yeah, except that if you go to any TV listing where it says, It says whatever the character's name is, now that Kristen knows that she is in hell, da 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 da. So the spoiler is out there. There's no getting around it. If a person at home listening has Netflix, wipe your mind of everything I've just told you and watch season one and watch it all the way through. It's worth it. I'm very surprised to say that there are not too many sitcoms that I would ever say that about. I need to promote something.
Okay, what is it?
It is October 3rd. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, NYRSF, everybody at home say NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, October 3rd, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 7 p.m., come about 6:30, Michael Swanwick and Gardner Dozois. I didn't write out a bio. Do you want to give it, Rick?
No.
I thought not. Swanwick... it's just a brilliant, 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 fun writer. He's written extraordinary fantasy. The Iron Dragon's Daughter.
Yes.
And it's not sort of non-sequel, but same universe. The Dragons of Babel.
Yeah.
Are among two of my favorite books in recent years.
Fantasy, yeah.
Yeah. And his... and on the science fiction side, Darger and who's the other? One of the two characters. One is a dog, a human.
Yes.
With
a dog face.
A human. With, human who happens to be a dog.
It's a human. Yeah, he's a dog. I mean, he's, you know, it's a genetic thing.
Yeah.
But he's a person, but he's a dog, and they're con artists. And they are slowly...
Partners
in crime. Yeah. Every single story or book. They're always moving east.
Right.
They're always moving east. And
as fast as possible.
Yeah, usually with minions.
The sheriff on their tail, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Swanwick is, I believe, the most nominated writer. That's between the World Fantasy Award... the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award.
And half a dozen others. Yeah.
And half a dozen others. He's gotten more nominations than any other writer in the history of genre. And when I have Swanwick on the air and I mention that, he says, which means I've lost more than anybody else. and he's just a sweet, wonderful guy and a good writer and a mensch.
A mensch, yes.
Besides being from Philadelphia.
Not everyone can be from Manhattan.
No, but what happens is when people who live in Manhattan move to Philadelphia, like Chip Delaney, I'll just grumble about that. Traitors. Traitors, people that move out of Manhattan, especially Delaney. He used to babysit for his daughter 30 years ago or something like that. In Manhattan. So anyway, Gardner Dozois was editor of Asimov's magazine for what, 24?
705 years.
705 years.
It was an amazing run.
No, it was an Asimov run.
Thank you.
Jesus. There's a magazine called Amazing. You
know. I'm thoroughly aware of this. Yes.
Yes. Amazing stories.
Amazing stories. No, he had two things going for him. He was the editor of Asimov's, and at a time when there weren't all that many year's bests, he had the year's best science fiction every year came out. And I mean, now there are dozens, year's best this, year's best that.
They're going to have to be year's bests of year's bests.
Perhaps that will happen. But he was a powerhouse in...
the industry.
In the industry, in science fiction, the science fiction aspect of it.
And a pretty good writer and editor.
Yeah.
He works with that guy, George Martin, is that his name?
Some independent author. I don't know.
Some indie author. Well, he is indies. He can buy some countries now. But they've done a dozen anthologies together. Or more.
Probably more.
And they've been working together again. George is either working with Gardner or he's working with Neil Gaiman. And everybody's saying, aren't you going to write the last book? And Neil Gaiman takes the mic away from George on stage. This really happened at Comic-Con last year. Mm. And everybody was saying, you know, write the book, write the book. And Gaiman takes the microphone and says, listen, everybody, George R. R. Martin is not HBO's bitch.
Well,
not anymore, he isn't.
No, I remember when he was just one more science fiction writer.
In New York.
And yes, in New York. Yeah. And Ellen Datlow published in Omni a couple of the first stories that really...
She published his first story.
Right.
She published William Gibson's second story.
But I mean, in his case, she was the one who brought him out, whereas Gibson...
So is he going to buy her a ranch?
I don't think so.
No, too bad.
He will, however. I mean, he's got that theater out in Santa Fe.
He's got a theater and he's building a movie studio.
Well, one of the things that he did, he had a house in Santa Fe, he still has it, which was devoted entirely to his collection of toy knights, knight figures. He had hundreds of thousands of them. It's kind of...
His people haven't figured out George is...
Really rich.
And a strange, wonderfully strange person. Benevolent.
By the standards of speculative fiction, he just doesn't seem that great.
Well, then he's a fan, yeah.
But yes, he...
great Tolkien expert.
Yes, he's done very well for himself.
Yeah, he really has. And I won't watch that show. That TV show of his.
You won't watch Game of Thrones.
I won't watch Game of Thrones for reasons that we were discussing earlier.
Ah, yes.
Gore. Not Al. What I call gornography. Mm. A term that I stole from The Guardian. And I wrote to the woman who, as far as I know, coined the phrase. And, you know, said, can I use this? And she said... I came up with that, and I said, no, you didn't, I did. But gornography meaning, when last episode I saw, Ned Stark was still alive.
Oh, my God.
That's how long ago. And I know what's going to happen to Jon Snow anyway. So, you know, it's not like... and also, it just isn't totally my cup of tea. I'm closer to your Doctor Who kind of person. And you and I, by the way, Madeline, had a discussion about, you were shocked that I really liked the movie Valerian.
I was.
And I went to see it a second time. I liked it more.
Really?
Yeah, I went with Terrence.
I haven't seen it.
And it's a Luc Besson film. And like most Luc Besson films, they start out getting terrible reviews, being dissed by everybody.
And then over the years, they grow to be cinematic classics.
Yes. I mean, The Fifth Element is not a great movie, but it was a dud when it came out. It didn't make any money. It lost a lot of money.
Yes. Today,
people think it's a wonderful original film. I wouldn't say it's a cinematic classic, but it's earned its place. And Valerian, I would say, is in that pantheon a little, not quite as good, especially given that the lead character, the male, can't act.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, he's a stick. He's a wooden stick.
That's a shame.
Is he somebody's boyfriend?
He is a model and a popular singer.
Oh.
And stuff like that. He has a following. And she I'm sorry, I'm forgetting everybody's names, including give her character's name, because the comic strip it's based on is Valerian and blank, her name.
Right.
But somehow her name got lost.
Of course.
In the movie title. Of course, exactly. But she's quite good. And Herbie Hancock, as the President of the United States, is a hoot and a holler. And Ethan Hawke is very good in the film, but is in the film all too short. And, of course, Rihanna.
Yes, I did hear she was in it.
And she's brilliant. Imagine a black Sally Bowes, right out of Cabaret, only she's a shape changer.
Interesting.
Oh, yes, very interesting. Online, people can find the first 5 minutes of Valerian to view. And it's the best 5 minutes of the movie, I will agree. But watch that, and then you will want to see the film. But I will tell you that it consists of the song Space Oddity.
Fine with that.
Oh, yeah. And it starts on a small screen. And as we see Apollo Soyuz astronauts meet and shake hands, and as we start moving into the future, into the present and the future from the small screen, in that moment in Space Oddity where the sound opens up and the song goes to full stereo, the small image goes to 16:9 IMAX nearby. Whoa! Okay. There are stunning, stunning moments. Don't look for a plot. Just go and have... And this is what Sam J. Miller and husband said. Of course, they're such Bowie fans. Simply, we went to see a movie and have a good time, and we had a great time. Is it a great movie? Doesn't matter. We had a great time. And, you know, end of review, end of story. I thought that was good enough. And so that's trying to defend myself to Madeline. And then I was shocked when Dan Persons reviewed it, and he liked it about as much as I did. Mm. It's not a great movie. It's merely really worth seeing in a summer of meh movies.
Yeah, this summer really hasn't been great for movies.
This was a disastrous summer for the movie makers.
It really was.
There hasn't been anything as bad as... I think to some extent it's television.
Television has been very good the last couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
But in terms of market, I think movies may be having some difficulty.
But television with shows like Legion,
so good. That is easily my favorite show to come out of 2017.
Uh-huh.
I have watched it twice, and both times I have been absolutely blown away.
Yeah, absolutely. Noah Hawley, you know, who also has done the three
Fargo's.
Seasons of Fargo, has written a couple of novels. And they're basically crime fiction and procedurals, and they're very good. And this guy is just... And it's the first time, finally, that Chris Claremont, who a regular guest on Hour of the Wolf, Chris, who wrote and edited X-Men for, well, over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the 12 X-Men movies, that includes like Deadpool is an X-Men movie, and Legion, which you don't even really realize is an X-Men thing. I had to have Terrence tell me after I had seen it. And, oh, God, he's still talking. He's at home alone, but he's still telling me. He's telling his cat now how it all works, how that's Professor X's wheelchair and...
I actually did know going in that it was related to X-Men, but only because that was kind of how they were hyping it up, you know, to get it appealed to a mass audience.
But Chris wrote the graphic novels or comic books that are 9 of the X-Men movies and has earned for all of those films, in terms of writing, exactly the same as I get paid for this radio show. Zip, zero.
Wow.
Nothing. Work for hire. You generally, you work for a comic book company. You don't own the characters. Marvel owns the characters.
Yes.
And all that. But Chris owns Legion. Chris created Legion. And at the end of every episode, it says, Chris Claremont.
How did he manage to do that?
I don't know. Next time I see him, and I almost did a couple of weeks ago, but then he had to cancel at a reading that Bob Howe was doing. Where we expected Chris to show up. I'll ask him.
Mm.
He's done movie reviews for us as well. He and I disagree on everything. It's great.
I mean, as a music technology student, I was so upset that that show did not get nominated for any technical awards. Sound editing, no sound mixing.
How about writing?
No writing, no cinematography, no nothing.
How about Aubrey Plaza?
Aubrey Plaza. That was just, she was just amazing.
I did know her because I had seen the movie Safety Not Guaranteed, but I hadn't connected her with that film, and I've never watched more than one episode of Parks and Recreation. That was the pilot before either Chris Platt or Aubrey Plaza got into it. But Aubrey Plaza in Legion will floor you. What a performance she should have been. She ought to have been a contender.
It's a shame. I was very upset the day the Emmy nominations came out, which is not a sentence I usually say because I don't usually pay that much attention to those type of nominations, but I was really rooting for Legion and nothing.
I'm very glad that Handmaid's Tale won so many awards,
yes, so
but I'm unhappy because it's Hulu. It's Fox. It's Murdoch.
Mm.
You know, look at the downside.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to subscribe to that. And no, I'm not going to subscribe to CBS either. Star Trek starts Sunday. Yeah. Right. Okay, I hope that all of you radio listeners out there saw Rick's expression. And if you're watching us, I haven't mentioned on the air, have I? We're on Facebook Live. If you go to, I think, my page, just Jim Freund on Facebook, you can see us. You really want to? I'll leave it up. It'll be there later. But we are on Facebook Live, so everybody can get that.
I didn't even know there was such a thing.
As Facebook Live?
Yes.
Yeah, you're on it.
Am I? How am I?
Yeah.
My life is just exciting.
It's like when you do a reading for us downstairs. And that's on live stream. This is Facebook Live. It's similar. Mm. Smaller. Smaller and more dangerous because anybody can do it. If you can figure out Facebook's crappy mobile interface.
It is pretty terrible, isn't it?
It really is. And it changes every day and gets worse all the time. So, Rick.
Yes.
Stop dominating all the discussion here.
I have absolutely no idea what you were talking about, so I decided not to.
Okay, who am you anyway, for those listeners who haven't heard you on this show
I'm
before?
A really old speculative fiction writer, and I've been doing this now for about 30 years, more than 30 years. And in the course of writing, I think 90 short stories have been published. One of them turned out to be There's a Hole in the City, which was my 9/11 story. It was an interesting thing with 9/11. Immediately after the event, there were a whole bunch of really not very good stories centered about it.
We should mention that you live within, shall we say, the shadow of the towers.
I watched it from from the corner that I live on. It was an amazing day. But what I wrote the story about, it's the day after 9/11 when basically Greenwich Village is like staggering around
unable to figure out what it is that's happened. And I go from that. And it's a ghost story in many ways. And it's speculative fiction, which I think really means it's a bit of horror and it's a bit of science fiction and it's a bit of fantasy in there. If when I die, there is one thing that I've done that will be remembered, it will be that story, I think. It's had an amazing run. It's available in several different forms online at this point.
It was published in Sci Fiction.
It's
edited by, we've said her name 1,000 times, why not 1,001?
You mean Ellen Datlow?
Huh?
Yes.
That's the one?
That's the one, yes. Yeah, that was, the story was a thing that wasn't good for anybody, 9/11, but that story has been very good for me.
It's also the lead story in one of your fix-up novels.
It is in Dust Devil and a Quiet Street. Yeah, I use that. Well, I said,
and for those listeners who don't know, a fix-up novel
is a bunch of short stories that follow one another and have about them finally an aspect of a novel. Faulkner did things like that.
Raymond Chandler
did things like that.
Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick, yes. Philip K. Dick did all.
Cage Baker,
yes.
Bless her, man.
Poor Cage Baker, yeah. No, she did that also. And it was a much more common form in years past than it is now. But yeah, that basically was one of the places that I used. There's a hole in the city. It was very strange. The days after, immediately after the fall of the towers, were, I believe, the most beautiful days that I've ever seen in Manhattan. The sunlight was incredible.
Even on the 11th, I remember.
Yeah, it was a...
The first thought in my mind is, I live in Brooklyn, and I could see the plumes going up of smoke, and it was otherwise such a beautiful day. Didn't somebody, in fact, write a song or a story about 9/11 called Such a Beautiful Day?
My goodness, I don't know if they did, but it would certainly be appropriate. It was... went on for a couple of days that way, and then the wind shifted, and it was smoke, and it was this very rancid smell that people were saying was the smell of concrete burning, but I think to some extent it was the smell of human bodies burning. When I was standing watching...
BAI in those days was at 120 Wall Street, so we were five blocks away.
When I was standing there watching this, there was a kid, Asian kid, with binoculars, and he was saying, they're jumping. I was seeing stuff coming off the top of the first tower and thinking that it was the tower disintegrating. When he began speaking, when he said that they're jumping, he took the binoculars away from his eyes, and it was just tears inside. The tears came down all over his shirt. And I realized, my God, those are people jumping off the tower. But in the days just after it, everyone was kind of in shock.
And the fact that there was no air traffic made everything that much more surreal.
And very quiet. Well, at one point, I picked up my phone and regular old telephone, and there was somebody on the line, and he said, this is Naval Command, for the next half hour we have possession of the New York telephone system, and what they were doing with this I don't know. He said, well, sorry, but you'll have to hang up, and I hung up. Now I don't know anyone else that this happened to, so it may have been a very, very strange, warped joke. But I was just very, I was walking with somebody uptown on, and a bunch of military trucks came by, army trucks came by, and one of them was beeping insanely, and I looked and I realized it was one of the kids from the Bopes Library access desk was also a member of the reserve, and she was driving a truck down, down to the, probably going down where she, nobody should have been going, down to the pit itself. But yes, it was a strange melange of horror and then of.
And these are images that people should bear in mind while listening to the story. And let me warn people, this is very strangely not a macabre down story. In some ways, it's very beautiful and bittersweet.
It was one of the things.
I say.
One of the things just after the. One of the things just after. People wanted to be able to do something, and that there was nothing for them to do, that they wanted to, you know, help the injured and things, and it was not something that was available to ordinary civilians. I was the only one in the science library at NYU who could come in. I live right around the corner from NYU, and I would sit at the information desk, and all of the kids, they were all at the computers. It was an interesting thing, the difference between men and women. The women cried openly at the computer. They would be, you know, mailing stuff to their parents and things. The boys, however, would jump up and go off to the men's room and come back with, like, red eyes where they had obviously, and say that they had allergies. And I thought, this is the difference. That women, when something goes wrong, are able to actually
deal with their emotions.
Deal with this, whereas guys have to make up some
snort coke or something.
Yeah. It was the only time you couldn't be old enough at that point for these kids. I mean, just the fact that I had managed to live as long as I had made me somehow, you know, he's, look how old he is and he's still alive. When I would get up from the desk, they would say, "You're coming back, aren't you?" And I'd say, "Yes, I'll be coming back in just a few moments." But it was.
How long did it take after, what day were you back at work? WBAI was off the air till about the 14th.
I was at work the day I would have worked the day of the event itself. I came in and put in some time, and then I
because there's no electricity at 120 Wall Street.
Well,
so fortunately
we had NYU had one of the things that NYU turned out that it was a kind of command center, and they had incredible amounts of stuff like sneakers and bras and boxer shorts and just boxes of this stuff in case there was some kind of an emergency, there was a flood in New York or something. And this was down in some cellar at NYU, and they brought it all up. None of this stuff, I mean, it was all in horrible colors and things like that, but a lot of the kids couldn't go back to their dormitory, so they were wearing, like, you know, orange pants, and it was very
hand-me-ups.
Yeah, it was a very, very odd. But yeah, I was back. I had something to do with myself, which was not, and that was I really liked that. I didn't like the event, but I liked the fact there was something I could actually do.
After the fact, now it took you 5 years to write this story. It didn't take you 5 years. The story didn't germinate for 5 years.
Well, the story was published after 5 years. I wrote it like after 4 years. There was that, immediately after the event, there were a whole bunch of not very good stories about it. And then there was a silence for a while. And then about the same time that I began writing There's a Hole in the City, all kinds of other stuff were written.
What are the ones that you like?
I can't say.
Didn't Jeffrey Ford do one?
I don't think so, but he may have. He may have. One of the things that I didn't do was to read anyone else's 9/11 stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He got a nice write-up in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, he did.
Because of Nora Jemison.
As a matter of fact, because of There's a Hole in the City, I got a very nice thing in
That's
the Times.
That's right, in the New Yorker also.
In the New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah, you got written up in the New Yorker.
Yeah, it was really, it's been so good to me. But yeah, it was those very strange days. One of the things, and I use this in the book, I came out the door on McDougal Street, and there were no cars moving. There was no the only vehicles that would come through would be occasional ambulance or something like that. It was a three-legged rat ran down the middle of the street, and I said, "This must signify something." I mean, it was just so like, my God, this doesn't really happen in real life, does it? Well, yes, apparently it did.
It's one of the signs that Rat Mansion would be brought to WBAN. On Tuesdays at midnight.
No, it was.
And Anne Marie Hendrickson. Everybody should listen to it. Sorry.
But yeah, it's probably this. There is a story. There are a couple of other stories that have done very well for me. They've won awards and things like that. But yeah, basically, there's a hole in this. It meant a lot.
So what are your award nominations, and what's the favorite stuff on your brag shelf? And then we should hear the story.
Well, the two things that I twice have won World Fantasy Awards, and they had this horrible. What the hell is that man's name from Providence, the writer?
Lovecraft.
Lovecraft. It's really ugly. They've changed the thing, but they
Gain
really...
Gain Wilson illustration.
It was really horrible. And I dressed them. I have them dressed at home. I gave them little aviator helmets, you know, World War One aviator helmets. I put sunglasses on them. They look spiffy. At this
they do.
Point.
They really. They're so dressed up. He would so dread it. But also the Gain Wilson depiction of H.P. Lovecraft as this awful human being, which of course he was.
Yeah.
A racist pig, terrible.
Well, the strange thing about it was that the Lovecraftians wanted to keep that horrible statue of Lovecraft. But anyway, yeah, those are probably the...
I have to say I'm not that fond of the new award, the Yggdrasil.
I don't really... Unless I win one of them, I'm not going to... But yeah, So the World Fantasy was
Okay,
was
so you
good.
Won two the World
Lambda,
Fantasy Awards.
Yeah, and Lambda. I won
the Lambda
Award
for Best Gay Science Fiction.
For Minions of the Moon, which was one tough book. Basically, it's about an alcoholic, drug addict kid. It was my story, basically, it was my life. So I won for that, and I won Million Writers Award. It's a very strange award, and I won that.
I helped you.
You stuffed
the ballot box.
You stuffed ballots, and I realized that you were missing. You were in the wrong profession.
Anybody could vote, and there were all these people that were getting their friends to vote for themselves.
I had my friends, but also I am Irish American, and I have a family the size of which you cannot.
I am also quite Irish.
I had guessed that, yes. But in this case, it really came in handy, and you know, relatives who had no idea what I was talking about came in and voted for the thing. So there was that.
But what put it over the top
was you.
It was me.
It was you. Yes, I admit it.
How many of the other competitors had somebody on the radio saying, "Go to this website and vote for Richard Bowes. He's the only... You should vote your conscience. Read all the stories. Then vote for Rick."
Right. It was like...
And
just...
then a year later at ReaderCon, Catherine M. Valenti comes up to me and she said, "I understand that you can cause people to win certain awards and that you can be bought for a price. What is your price?" And I said, "Sugar-free chocolate, quality sugar-free chocolate, a small bar of sugar-free chocolate." And We were in a hotel in the middle of nowhere outside of Boston. 20 minutes later, I had my bar of sugar-free chocolate, and a month later, she won the award. You can't, now, this was...
Well, I will tell you something. She had asked me, how did you do that?
Well, I knew that.
And I said...
That was apparent.
It was Jim Freund who did it. And because she was sort of harassing me, and I...
But then I stopped doing it, of course, because...
Then you did, because you were a man of probity and...
Well, also, the other...
Man of fairness.
The other fiction that I read was, frankly, not very good.
No.
And none of it was spec fic, and none of it was really of professional quality. So I really didn't have a problem pushing you and Kat. But then, after that, the caliber of nominated stories... got really good.
Yes.
And there were people where I knew more than one of the nominees. And at that point, I just said, no,
it would
I'd
be
stop.
Unfair. It would be unfair at that point. Yeah, it was, that was Ellen. That was Ellen Datlow was the one who pointed me in the direction of...
Of me?
No, of Million Writers, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, she's...
Ellen is a great pointer.
Yeah, no, she's been great for me.
She's a resource.
Yeah.
So, why don't we listen? First, let me say that you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me... Richard Bose, and running the console and aiding and abetting the show, Madeline Flieger, who is standing by to press. Do you have the pot up for the cart machine?
I do.
Yeah, okay, very good. So, cart machine, CD player is what I meant to say.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Yeah, and so whenever you are ready. Which is to say, whenever the CD player is ready. Every time Lister comes in, he says, is anything working?
well, it's always something that's working.
I'm going to come over and see. I think it should be one of these two pots. And then... Of course, we don't even have a remote play button here. So...
That's for sissies.
It is running.
It is running.
And... Aha! I think I know the problem. In the console, see? That button? Yeah, try that. Yeah, make them all green. Push them all in. There's no reason ever to turn any of them off. That one isn't on. That pot, there, yeah. Is it not going on this pot? Okay, let's try another CD player. Failing that, I actually have a digital copy. But that digital copy was probably the one in which I lost and didn't have an edit.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
So, somebody left their CD in there, of course.
My name is Jim Freund. As you have been hearing on our promos, we are going to have a reading of Richard Bowes' very special story, There's a Hole in the City, a fabulous piece of speculative fiction. And I am going to tell you all about Richard and Dr. Charles B. Strozier, who will be coming in after the reading is over to discuss this, and we will talk about the short story. But at this time, we're going to begin that story on such a very special day.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes, Wednesday, 9/12. 01 On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly, but the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd, ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification, waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho, people who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' face faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. "Couldn't sleep much last night," I said. "Because of the quiet," she said. "No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping, anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice." I said, "Notice how, with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies. Like 1965 all over again." She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a run-down building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he had made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's ancient airs and dances played. "Like the Blitz," someone said. "Never the same again," said a person at another table. "There isn't even any place to volunteer to help," a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. "Mrs. Pirelli," I said, "the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames on television. Her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death." Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot on his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone.
And you woke up?
No, I tried to call you. But the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that. But Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. "There's a hole in the city," said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed watching but not seeing some old movie on TV, avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. Cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second-floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged. "Anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said good night, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV set up in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who'd made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Thursday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, "Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it." "Hi, Mags," I said. "You want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall, normally used by faculty, on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown opens at cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now. It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it." "Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in?" It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. "There are others," she said, "kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village." "Jesus," I said. "Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't." This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. "He'll want to find us," she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she had been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, bit of a little wise-ass who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. How's it going? It sucks. My stuff is all downtown, where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, Bic razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned, and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night, staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me. He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please? So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed and a squad car with its roof crushed were hauled up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich Villages gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it, for the first time, the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. "If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it?" He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here." I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw and asked a place," she said, her voice clear and crazed, "the ones all burned and drowned. They were on the General Slocum when it caught fire." "The kid you saw and asked a place, all burned and drowned," I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes. The connection started to dissolve into static. "Where are you, Mags?" "Ground Zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet?" she shouted into her phone. "Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here." At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. "Mags, give me your number. Call me back," I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. She saw those kids? I saw them, too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night. You talked to the counselors? I asked. He drained the bottle. Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy. You understand. The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. The Air Force, I said, making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit. Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff? So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. Okay, he said. You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff? When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown on the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got to talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, "There isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats." I murmured, "He's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin." "Or eating his yappy dog," said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the east and west villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, "This is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep." I left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently. That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid who'd also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue, last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle and a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station was open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked, and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street in the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us, and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself." And none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white, and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact," and Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors, were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivors' party. In the days of the French Revolution, the Terror, that's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On Sixth Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped. "Here comes the bride," leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of Sixth Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black-and-white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street. I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back, but the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across Sixth, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank-you note on the fridge, signed by all three kids, and I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about, bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we three had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him, and he disappeared. I looked aside, and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, and even after. And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me, three sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mags' building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang the super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mags. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up Sixth Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened, and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9-23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9-11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. "Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to," he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. "Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions," I said to Roger. "Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell?" As he said that, flame sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her." Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. "Was that them?" Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. "Be smarter than we were," I said. And Marco said, "Sure," with all the confidence in the world.
You've been listening to There's a Hole in the City, copyrighted by the author, Richard Bowes, who was the reader as well. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is The Next Hour. My name is Jim Freund, filling in for the French couple who are at the moment in Belgium. That would be Janet Coleman and David Dozer. And with me,
Kill the CD. And because this program isn't the next hour will be on Monday with Janet Coleman and David Dozer and stuff like that. Rick, why don't you get near a microphone? So instead of the next hour, this is the current Hour of the Wolf. And nonetheless, I am Jim Freund, and this is nonetheless WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored. Well, you just heard me say it, but that was on recording in a... Gee, this isn't that old a recording, but my voice, very different.
It is, your voice changed, yes.
Yeah, finally. Yeah. I've been waiting how many years for my voice to change?
This is the thing I remember for being in choir in Catholic schools. They used to constantly make jokes about castration if they had some kid that had a really beautiful voice.
So with us on Hour of the Wolf, our guest is Rick Bowes, or Richard Bowes, as is
as nobody calls me.
No,
as,
but that's how people read you.
That is true.
And at the console, Madeline Flieger. And I need to get near a microphone, do I?
Need to move over.
To be on camera. Yeah. Is that it? Yes. And those who are foolish enough can... Actually, those are the wrong headphones. These are the right ones. Can be watching this on Facebook Live. And I see that a few faithful listeners actually have been doing that, and I'm mortified to find that out. But it's fun. It's sort of fun to play with Facebook Live. It's a do-it-yourself kind of a thing. Oh, and Madeline, who is an engineer on the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, you see, there's a way that we can use this. This can become another camera in the room.
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, there's a thing on the live stream software that says, remote camera phone. And I'm going, ooh, so that like during intermission, we could go into the crowd and, or even better, Q&A.
Oh, that's a good idea.
When people want to ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, shove the phone in their face and there'll be an insert box and all that. Maybe you and I should take a look at that software.
Yeah, definitely.
Sometime, because that sounds like a really worthy experiment. And let me just pitch one more time. The next New York Review of Science Fiction Reading is coming up in but a couple of weeks, October 3rd, Tuesday, October 3rd at 7 p.m. at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Thank you. And Michael Swanwick and Gardner Dozois, Google them, okay? These are Googleable people.
If ever there was a Googleable person.
If you could,
Mr. Swanwick.
He's an exceedingly Googleable person, and the lovely Marianne Porter. Okay, so we are going to throw a curve at Madeline.
Okay.
And that curve is that we're going to take a phone call. And Madeline has never run this console before.
This is true.
So you can see that, oh, they stopped calling.
Yeah. Well.
Okay, but those pots that are next to the CDs, right? There are two blue pots that are down. Bring both of those up. Okay, and now hit that green button that is lighting up. WBAI, you are on the air. Ooh. Maybe you aren't. There we go. Okay, the yellow button, so you can bring those other pots down. Okay, Robert, and so yes. Is you. What do you want?
Good morning, Madeline. Welcome to the proceedings.
Hi, thank you.
I said, because I think I've heard Rick's story seven times.
That means you haven't been listening to the rebroadcasts.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I said that this is one of those stories that transcends time and place, and that 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, it will be one of those stories that you hear, and it doesn't matter when and it doesn't matter where. Now, I've heard this story more than half a dozen times, and at least in three cases, I've broken down before the middle.
Yeah. The thing is that the one thing, Rick, I submit, that could change the timeliness of the stories, if God forbid. And by the way, good Rosh Hashanah, good Happy
yes,
New Year.
Yes, yes, good Rosh Hashanah, Happy New Year, James.
And since we are at the end of Talk Like a Pirate Day, it's Arr, Happy Rosh Hashanah, Shona Torah. Anyway, so I could combine both
Jewish pirates
celebrations.
Yes, yes.
Is if there were another catastrophe, it would then be missing. But outside of that, you've got the General Slocum.
Yeah.
And the Triangle Shirtwaist. And all the other fun.
Well, you know, they haven't done it in the last year or so, but it used to be some group of people went through my neighborhood and chalked in the names of women who had lived in various of the buildings and who had died in the Triangle Shirtwaist. There was a young girl.
We just had the 100th anniversary, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah. And they haven't done that recently, but it was an amazing thing. There was a house, a building over on Thompson Street. It was a mother and two daughters who had died in the fire, and they lived on Thompson Street.
Mm. Yeah. Mr. Bowes.
And there were a lot of neighborhoods in New York City that revolved around breweries or shirtwaist factories or whatever, that the people would live within walking distance of the place that they worked. And apparently that was very true with the Triangle Shirt disaster. A lot of women who died in that lived right around that area.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask Rick Bowes.
They could walk to work. Yeah.
I wanted to ask Rick Bowes a question, but James's mention of good place, bad place. And the first thing that came to mind is an old Twilight Zone story. The one about Rocky Valentine, the would-be second-rate criminal who dies and thinks he's gone to the good place because he gets everything he wanted, money, women, cars, can rob banks, and at the very end, he can't take it anymore because it's too static, it's too perfect, and he yells at the keeper, I don't belong here, this can't be the good place, and the other guy says, Mr. Valentine, this is the bad place.
Well, the TV series The Good Place doesn't relate to that much.
No. Anyway, I wanted to ask Rick Bowes a question. You know, Rick, they say if they like it once, they'll love it twice. And I have often said, and I will stand on the ramparts with a broken bourbon bottle in each hand defending this, I think your best book is that wonderful little fairy tale collection of yours. And I was just wondering if you had ever thought of doing a sequel.
That's a good question, actually.
What was the question?
About a sequel to your fairy tale book. The one from Aqueduct Press.
Oh, the one from Aqueduct Press.
The Queen, the Camber, and Other Tales.
The Queen and the Cambion.
I love that book.
By me, anyway.
So, the question is... Oh, you're not wearing your headphones.
No,
you can't hear the caller.
No, I can't hear the caller.
Put on your headphones, Rick. You've been
doing this show.
All right,
I'm listening, yes.
Longer than I have. Jeez.
All right, I'll repeat the question.
No, don't.
Okay.
The question is are you thinking, might you write a sequel to...
Well, it would be...
More fairy tales.
It's a collection. It's a collection of fairy tales. I have thought about doing another little book like that. I just... loved The Queen and the Cambion.
As did I.
Just the size of it. But I haven't really quite thought out what the next book would be, and I haven't approached Aqueduct Press about it, so I don't know.
Because that's the only story, or the only, with the Queen and the Cambion is the only one where Merlin, instead of growing older that I've ever read, grows younger.
No, that's not the only one.
No, that's not an uncommon
motif. That's a regular trope, in fact. There was some writer named, I think it was T.H. White.
T.H. White, yes, did that.
Once and Future King, yes.
Yeah, once
yes,
and
that,
King.
And Merlin lives backwards in the Once and Future King. And Le Morte d'Arthur. These are the classic Arthurian texts. Merlin lives backwards. Is that... My phone.
It is your phone.
Dinging at me. These are. You see, I've got to explain to the Facebook Live viewers, I can't see your comments. So, okay, I'm going to reverse the camera now that we got it in a good place. No, it's just people logging in and logging out is all. How's the placement again, Madeline? Thank you. Yes. You see, unlike us, who learned to engineer and sort of at WBAI by self-defense in order so that our shows
survival.
Go over the air, Madeline's actually a professional at this stuff.
Training to be a professional.
Training to become yes.
That's more than a lot of our sessions.
No.
Okay, thank you, Robert.
Yes.
Okay, have a good morning. If people... Yep. No, I think you have to hit the off button. Yep, that was it. And if anybody else would like to call up, our telephone number is 347-3... Okay, let me... 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. One of the least... mnemonic phone numbers in the history of WBAI. I can remember phone numbers that began Oxford 7.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, we had two major Oxford 7 exchange numbers.
Yep. That was amazing. Neighborhoods would have their own...
Get nearer to the mic.
Neighborhoods would have their own introductory numbers.
That's right.
Yeah, it was...
It's like, where do you live? Oh, I'm at Illinois 8, or I'm at Tarryton.
That's right, yeah. It was, and then there were the nice neighborhoods. You would know that this person lived in a nice neighborhood.
And there was even the movie Butterfield 8.
Butterfield 8, yes.
Is that where that came from?
Yes. Yeah, that Butterfield was a number.
Well, it was an exchange.
Yeah.
It was an exchange, and Elizabeth Taylor is a call girl.
That's
whose
a real,
phone number is Butterfield 8 something.
That's a real story. I mean, almost everything in that movie actually happened.
Really?
Yes.
I'll have to watch it one day.
She was killed in reality on a boat going from Boston to New York. Somebody threw her into the gears.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
And it turned out, I believe that... Somehow she was the ward of a man who molested her, basically.
Mm.
And that was the story of the woman.
Wow.
And then John O'Hara turned it and produced a book, Butterfield 8.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was Butterfield 8, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just doing the lookout for Lister, which is, oh, God. Of course, if Lister's running late, what he does is he phones me. And this is the problem when your phone is your camera, is your Facebook, is your this and your that, and you can't separate their various functionalities. So,
looks like we have a call on line one.
Okay, well, let's take the call. And good morning. You are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. I want to tell Rick that the Hole in the City is just, every time I hear it, I love it more. I get more out of it. I realize things about it that I didn't realize in the previous times. And I am coming to the conclusion that this is the best story ever written.
Well, Rick agrees with that.
I agree. I think perhaps it's a really good story, I believe, but I don't think it's the best by any means. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Some of the reasons why I identify with it so much is that I went to school at NYU during the late 60s, and I was working in the Tamiami Library during the late 90s and at the time of 9/11. So I really identify with all the things about the university and the Triangle Fire. I go to the memorial every year, and so it just resonates with me so much.
Why, I'm glad that you liked it as much as you did. You worked in Tamiami.
Yes.
I was working a couple of floors below you. I was on the 9th floor in the science library.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah. And when the 9/11 occurred, most of the librarians couldn't get to work, so I was the only one there in that particular place in the library. But yeah, Tamiami was an amazing collection.
Well, I hope I get to read other things that you've written. I hope I do find them in some sort of recorded format or as a file so that I can read it.
Well, gee, Rick, why don't you say the names of some of your books?
Well, yes, I have.
Yes, spontaneously.
Spontaneously, yes, in a very strange manner. There are novels which are fix-ups, basically. They're collections of stories that have been turned into a novel. It would be Minions of the Moon and Dust Devil on a Quiet Street would be the two. There are also short story collections, the names of which I am now...
Streetcar Dreams.
Streetcar Dreams, yes. Oh, my goodness.
I'd look at my phone, but I can't look at my phone.
I can't look at your phone either. but yes. God, this is so embarrassing.
Bowes, Richard Bowes, ask for it by name.
Yeah, take a look in Amazon. Some of them will be there.
And there are some audio versions.
There are. If you go online, you can find and just put in my name and online stories, and some should come popping up.
Yeah, there's stuff you can read online.
Also, are you on Facebook?
No, I'm not.
Are you on Twitter, whatever that is?
No, I'm old-fashioned.
Well, you're very fortunate. I've wasted more of my time on those than is believable. But yeah,
I'm a woman who's listening to the radio.
But yes, I'm so glad that you like the story. I myself adore my own story. That particular story is very dear to me.
Rick has several books out, and
I have eight books.
Eight books in print. Yeah. And I find them all worthy. I am a particular fan of that one story, which is why we play it every year. And why there's a special issue, maybe we'll put it up again at some point, that WBAI put out and is available at premiums during certain fund drives.
That's right. I happen to have one in my hand right now.
So you have.
Yes.
Matt, who is... The other person in this building at the moment is the person who created those, did a nice job on the cover. Yes. The cover of the CD is a picture of the city. And since it's a CD, well, there's a hole in the city. So. Well, 1 second for the Facebook Live people.
Oh, my God, you're going to show it to them.
Yes. Oh, it's radio. You have to show, hold up stuff for the radio. normally, by the way, this show is over. Well, where's Lister?
I don't know, but we've got a comment from someone on Facebook Live who says that we want to see Lister's striptease.
Oh, well, he did that last week on the air.
Ah.
Or was it 2 weeks ago? Yeah, but everybody does, starting with Rick.
I mainly come here to see Lister take off his clothes, yes.
Sure. So thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Have a great
day. Good
night. Or morning. Okay, thanks. Yeah, unfortunately, Madeline, you see all those nice phone lines? Only the first one works.
What a shame.
Yeah. Kel disaster. Mm. We won't go into the days when we could conference call them and all kinds of stuff like that. But, yeah, usually Lister, I am going to take the phone into my own hands for a moment because usually Lister does call.
Usually.
Max Schmid. Oh, Max Schmid says we want to see Lister striptease. Well, Max, for you, I'm sure, a private performance can be arranged. Max was just here. You know Max.
Yes, I know.
We all know Max. Ah! I went into selfie mode. I didn't mean to do that. Anything but. How do I get into un-selfie?
No, I'm surprised at Lister that he...
Yeah, well, it happens because he lives near, like, the G train or something. You know, the worst possible...
I can remember
being in train stations.
And the G train would come into the station and there was like nobody on the G train. Be like a couple of old people and that would be it.
Did I hear a door?
Yes, you did.
Did I hear a door? Yeah. Now it's about time. Max wants to watch you striptease.
A vast public wants to watch you striptease.
Hello there.
How are you?
Hello.
Good to see you.
It's been a long time since I've seen you.
Good to see you.
You're on camera. Just thought I'd let you know.
Okay. Well, I've done much worse.
Good morning.
On
good morning. Good to see you.
Madeline Flieger, Lister Howe. Say your whole name for me. I just call you Lister always.
You too.
Lister. You just like to be Lister.
Yeah,
just
Lister.
Mr. Lister. Just Lister, Yeah, first name Just, exactly. And Just Mote It Be. Yes, we actually had on Facebook a listener request for you to do exactly what you are doing right now. Is he on camera?
He is on camera.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So okay. I hope you all get what you're paying for. My outro music is on there, and it's called Sails of Silver, so you'll want to get that ready. But we need to give Lister enough time to get ready so he can come over. I figured, what train is it you live near?
Number 203.
Oh,
number
3.
Goodness.
Number 3?
Yeah, that
comes
from Utica.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that, oh.
Yeah, no, that will explain it indeed. So, Rick, what do you have coming up professionally?
A whole bunch of anthologies. An Alice in Wonderland anthology.
Yes, the Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter and March Hares.
And March Hares, yes. Edited by nobody we've ever heard of. It's
a young person who needs a helping hand here.
She's getting one because I'm actually going to help produce the launch party for that book.
Oh, my God. Are you going to go up to Mr. Connecticut with the rest of us?
I guess not, because I didn't know she had booked Mystic. No, I think this is a New York launch. A New York party, anyway. Tea party.
And is it going to be in the KGB building?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, that'll be fun.
Yes.
So I have that.
In the Red Room.
I have that, and I also have your dystopia. A dystopia, which it's just 42 anti-Trump short stories.
Only 42.
Well, you know, you got to start.
You've got to start. You need
45.
Yeah, but I think 52 would be a good number. An anti-Trump short story for every week. This week's anti-Trump story is called Dump.
And then there is yet another...
The Redheaded Terror.
Yet another anthology. Oh, that isn't red hair. That isn't even hair.
Yeah, that's not hair.
No, that's...
And then what it is, but it's
then
not
there's
hair.
Another. There's another anthology, which I don't think will be out this year. It'll be out next year. And it's a ghost anthology, and it's about a painter from the 1960s, 1970s, who mm-hmm. is killed. He falls off a building that he's
painting
stuff on, and he comes back to the city to win back his prestige to become again the young artist. That should be next year. And let's see, what do I... Right now I'm writing a sequel to a story that won me some awards called If Angels Fight.
Oh, wow.
And it's this one...
That's also in Dust Devil.
Right. No, that isn't.
Oh, no, that's in If Angels Fight.
That's right. It's in the anthology If Angels Fight. But it's lines from Shakespeare's Richard II, If Angels Fight, then mere men must fall. And this one will be Mere Men Must Fall, will be the sequel.
Oh, okay, so... You're finishing the quote.
Well, it's, you know, it begins with Irish Boston politics from the 1950s and 60s.
Tell us when you're ready, Lister, and we'll start my outro music.
So, Dad, it's been a good year, actually, for me.
Good. I'm pleased to hear that. Yes, I have stuff. Well, October 3rd is mentioned with Michael Swanwick and Gardner Dozois,
yes.
7 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue, admission free, donations
with caveats.
Encouraged.
Yes.
No caveats, and we will turn nobody away for lack of funds. But the day before that, October 2nd, here on WBAI, from 3 to 5 p.m., they will finally acknowledge my 50th anniversary working at the station.
Yay.
So, how old were you when you started?
13.
Isn't that illegal?
Depends on what I did. And the answer is yes. I was fetching coffee for Chip Delaney and Tom Dish. And
that's illegal.
Especially for Tom Dish.
Oh, boy. He was a piece of work.
And ended up being pieces of work, no. I had to do that. And by the way, and this is absolutely true, I'm not making this up, later in, not this year, but next year, we're going to be doing a tribute. Henry Wessels is going to produce a tribute to Thomas M. Dish.
Well, he had greatness, he had horribleness. I remember it was out on 13th Street near the gay, lesbian, whatever.
I think Lister's almost ready.
We're
well into his airtime.
Oh, no, Lister.
Or airspace, is it? No, there's a chair going over my airspace at the moment.
No, there were a bunch of drag queens around the building, and I was coming up the street, and they were all, ooh, and I thought, this can't be me. We've all seen each other. It was Thomas Dish walking by the other side of the street, and he turned and he said, "Hello, girls." And they just like, oh.
Well, Karen Russell, who's now a huge name, who was simply a good name in The New Yorker and now is like, you
bigger
know,
than God.
Yeah. And I have to write her. But the first time I got her to read for us, I teamed her with Thomas M. Dish. And
well, no, that's a pair.
It worked well.
Yeah.
And she said, I don't know that name. And I said, well, have you ever heard of the novel Camp Concentration or 334? She said, no, not offhand. And then I said, well, how about the Brave Little Toaster? And she said, oh, my God, the Brave Little Toaster. I read that when I was a little girl. I love that story so much. I love it.
Oh, she's lying. She was never a little girl.
No, well, the thing is, I said, don't tell Tom that. You know, it's like,
oh, I don't know.
That when you're a little girl.
He was a little girl. I mean, he was a little girl hiding inside the body of an enormous man.
And this has been Hour of the
Wolf. I got to say,
Madeline.
He was hard to put up with.
But he was a great writer. And
he was a great writer. He could be a wonderful person, but he could also, he was scary.
He was very scary, and there was a 15-year period in which he was barred from this show. And I'll tell that story when we get closer to the tribute to his life and work. Madeline, what have you coming up in the world?
Well, I will be at the New York Review of Science Fiction's reading on October 3rd. I'll be there engineering.
You will.
So keep an eye out for
Terrence
me.
And I have decided that I'll set it up. You know, in other words, I'll do the setup part. And actually, you can watch that and learn that. Because for some reason, I was successful last time. But then you are the engineer. It's yours.
Cool. I'm excited for it.
And thank you so much for engineering Hour of the Wolf.
But of course.
So, speaking of which, it's time for us to say good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morgan, says Lister. And so this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you, Madeline Flieger and Richard Bowes, for being here. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper on camera, on Facebook. Well, I'll be taking my phone with me this time. And we'll be back next week with more interesting stuff. Actually, we have some very interesting and exciting guests coming up. So I'll tell you more about it when I can remember them. So Hugh Howey on October 3rd, whatever. And at any rate, again, everybody, please be good to each other. You deserve it. We deserve it. Take care and good morning.